Weekends are better when you spend it with us. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk TNT.
And thanks for joining me and staying with me today on the show Weekends. This is hour 7 of 8 for the big weekend blockbuster, where no stone remains unturned, does it? We are always searching for answers, details, information, solutions, and hopefully a way out of the mess that we're in. Imagine being just a humble bloke, going about your business, driving a forklift and paying the bills and perhaps just planning for a family. And then one day, through no fault of your own, through just being able to practice a thing called informed consent, all that's taken away. What do? Where do you go, and how do you deal with it? Do you conform? Do you do what you're told? Or perhaps do you say, I'm not doing any of that. I'm going to go the other way, and I'm going to follow my own path, and I'm going to light it up for myself, my family, in the entire world. Well, I'm delighted to be able to introduce you to my next guest. His name is Nathan Livingstone. He is the face and creator of Milk Bar TV. And more or less, that's pretty much what he has done. So back in 2021, he was fired from his job as a forklift driver because of the, you know what, vaccine mandates. And he started his Twitter page to create videos pointing out the hypocrisy, corruption, and overall tyranny of the COVID response. He didn't have any expectation that the videos would be widely seen, but more and more people resonated with them. And one after another, they began to go viral. If you cut to 2023, it was his biggest year for him personally and professionally. He became a dad. A community of like-minded people and friendships continues to build. The videos have amassed tens of millions of views, and he's proud that he got the place where he can now do the business that he does love to do, creating videos full-time. And you can check out his work at ADHTVAUS or Oz. Nathan Livingstone, welcome to Weekends.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
Good to see you and good to have you on the show. Who would have thought? You're 2 years on and you've got an entirely new career. Do you talk to your old workmates in the forklift business and do they look at you and think that you're some sort of celebrity now?
No, I don't. But I'll tell you what, when I quit forklift driving, that final day, telling my boss that I was quitting to make videos full time, I never even told him that I make videos on the side. So I think that was a first for him. He's had one of his employees to quit forklift driving to then go on to make films.
Isn't it a wonderful thing when people have this preconceived idea about a particular person entirely based on their own biases, and you can just break or shatter that glass ceiling in just a moment by simply telling them, nope, I'm out of here and I'm going to go off and do what I do. It must be a wonderful feeling to just reflect on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reason I started Milk Bar TV and making videos was just as a kind of cathartic expression, and also just something to do with my time as well. Just, you know, very bizarrely, I found myself in a position where it was illegal for me to work. So I had a lot of time on my hands and had a lot of feelings about what was going on and what I was seeing. So I just channeled all of that into making videos and into this account and this thing called Milk Bar TV, and people just ended up resonating with it, and it's just kind of snowballed from there.
So how did you get the skills to just start making video? Was it completely self-taught? Did you have an interest from your school days? How did it come about?
No, I mean, I've always loved filmmaking. You know, the forklift driving was just a way to earn money and pay the bills. Filmmaking has always been my passion. It still is my first love. In 2020, it was actually my most productive year as a independent filmmaker. I'd kind of finally got myself in a position where I was working really hard, and I'd made 3 short films that year and had a bit of momentum behind it. And then with the lockdowns, it just put a, you know, immediate stop to that. And so that was frustrating. But that's the thing. I'd never made anything political before the pandemic and before I lost my job because of vaccine mandates. I was literally making horror films. before lockdowns and before the pandemic. So I found that I had these set of skills. So I was kind of somewhat uniquely positioned when I then applied them and directed them at the Australian government, particularly to begin with, and Dan Andrews particularly, that I don't know, I had this kind of like this arsenal of skills that were kind of ready to be deployed. So I think that's why people resonate with them, because they're quite unique. I put a lot of effort into them, and I put a lot of experience that I've gathered over a lot of time into filmmaking. So I they kind of I think you can kind of tell what Milk Bar TV videos are because they're quite unique.
Oh, it's wonderful, isn't it? And to think that your training was in horror films. I mean, when you look at the COVID experience, you couldn't have had a better script, if you will, if you were going to make a horror film. It just follows the script to a T, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I also love dystopian and sci-fi films. So even kind of watching and observing it, it was very interesting, with a love for that kind of genre, watching a lot of those films to actually experience it in real time to see what films have got right and what films couldn't have predicted. It was very interesting. I'm sure everyone kind of meditated on that, how we're kind of living through this real-time dystopia setting that's even rolled on to now in Australia.
Just on that, and I'm sure as you're speaking, people are reflecting on perhaps a particular film, for example, that they've seen. These particular a virus gets out, obviously, or something like that. I'm thinking of the movie Sphere with Dustin Hoffman, was another strange one from many years ago, probably 25 or 30 years ago now. It's just one of them that comes to mind, but they're everywhere, aren't they? The particular dystopian horror films of some disaster becoming, Earth here, and so. It wasn't too far from. We were well trained, if you will, one way or another, to not even know or distinguish between what was fake and what was real. We had Agenda 201, this seeming dress rehearsal in October of 2019, predicting a coronavirus would escape, and not 2 months later it did. Vaccine hesitancy was something they brought up, and it was, and here we are. You're looking at this situation, and it didn't even feel real for some time. It's almost as if we were overtrained by Hollywood, if in one way or another, to just buy into this because that's just the way things have been predictively programmed for so long.
Yeah, absolutely. And you saw that being able to weaponize panic first over this virus, and people handing over all the power and safety and security to the government, as they really kind of pushed the fear and really kind of amped up the threat that this virus posed, despite many of us at the time and then very clearly now realizing the virus wasn't anywhere near the kind of threat that they were actually stating it was. But also then how they weaponized the hate and division then with the vaccine and then putting people into categories of vaccinated and unvaccinated. It was very interesting just to see the mainstream media in lockstep with the government and seemingly working together to kind of push this propaganda. I found it amazing in that kind of one space of the pandemic over a couple of years. I had a very close friend who I was going to be the best man at his wedding, and he actually ended up breaking up with his fiance because of just the stress and everything that was going on with the lockdowns. And he confided to me that he was feeling suicidal. So he broke the rules during the lockdown, and he actually came over to my place so we could kind of spend time together because he just needed some connection. And then when I lost my job and made the decision to not get the vaccine, he then called me out very publicly on Facebook saying that I was an idiot. So somehow in that one space, I went from kind of safety with me helping him to then him then calling me out. So it was just amazing to see how that kind of narrative shifted and how the government and the media were able to kind of really push this propaganda of fear.
It's an extraordinary personal story to share, and there must be many, many situations like that. But here you are going out of your way to help a friend in need, and putting your own, well, reputation, etc., at risk, in the sense that, you know, you're defying these ridiculous rules to help someone out in need, and then to go the other way. It's almost as if human loyalty was pushed to the brink, and these invisible rules or social mores, if you will, must trust the government over my friend, somehow took precedence because of a fear. But that fear was a coronavirus, and as you rightly said, you know, very, very minimal death rate, survival rate around 99% or higher, regardless of age. I made this point the other day, people won't remember this, but you know, when before the vaccine in Australia, not a single female in Australia died from COVID under the age of 50 before the vaccine came out. So what were we afraid of, Nathan?
I mean, you look back now, and I continue to kind of look back, just because I think it's important to unpack what the hell happened, you know, particularly in Australia. And you just see the number of COVID cases that were active in the community, especially in Victoria, you know, and we're talking about like single digits at times, and yet the entire state is locked down. People under curfew and unable to leave their houses. I mean, it's absolutely insanity, but it just speaks to how people can really lose their minds and completely lose the ability to, you know, to critically think and to weigh up benefits and risks at the time. It's very concerning. I still think a lot of us are questioning what it means to be Australian, and are questioning how this actually happened, and are very worried that it could happen again.
Well, this is it, isn't it? You know, you're looking back and you're thinking, what have we actually learned? We haven't had a COVID Royal Commission as promised by Albanese. We have to push for our own citizens' inquiry. We've compared the terms of reference of the New Zealand government, for instance, against the New Zealand citizens' COVID inquiry. The citizens have come up with over 200 points of reference. The government, 23. It's like they're not even interested to getting to the bottom of it. That's obvious. But what happens if something comes about again, if it's a disease X, if it's a climate lockdown, heaven forbid, more nonsense that we've got to put up with? Imagine that. We're going to close you all down because the temperature went up. I mean, it's beyond ridiculous. The other point I want to make here is the point in Australia, an egalitarian society, we've been told our whole lives, everyone gets a fair go, a fair deal, equality. Yes, we have the voice situation, which was kind of a reverse discrimination or racism scenario. But the idea of pitting vaccinated against unvaccinated was about the lowest you could go. The name calling all the way up to the Treasurer of Australia calling unvaccinated people cookers is about as disgusting as you can get. The term anti-vaxxer, like some form of derogatory term, the opposite being absolute vaxxer, something that can never be criticized regardless of what you're looking at, is a form of fanaticism that's going on here. And you just look at it and you think, how did we get to a situation that a preventative medicine, if it worked, would prevent the person? It's nobody's business who takes it and who doesn't take it. And yet this all went out the window. It's like everyone misunderstood entirely what this particular product was meant to be, that it was always going to fail. And therefore, it was just a bullying thing that take it no matter what, because if we all go down, if one of us goes down, we all go down anyway. It's such a loser mentality. It's despicable. And I just can't believe that it even forms part of our country. That's how mad I get about it. Do you get that mad as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think history has been very kind to those of us who resisted vaccine mandates or questioned them. I continually, as more and more boosters rolled out and COVID remained, and pretty much eventually everyone ended up catching COVID, pretty much everyone managed to survive. I don't think I know anyone who's up to date on boosters. You know, I think I've even kind of lost count of what number they're up to, and what the official health guide was. But I mean, they were still recommending people to get boosters up to at least the fourth one. And I know pretty much next to no one that got up to date with those, because they all ended up weighing up the benefit and the risk of COVID, and then with the COVID vaccines, and making an informed decision for themselves, which is what, we did from the very beginning. It just took them so much longer to kind of come to that conclusion. And once the kind of propaganda and the fear kind of faded away, they were then able to make that informed decisions for themselves, which everyone should have done from the very beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. Now we're going to take our first break. When we come back, I'm going to talk to Nathan about his take on Australia's e-safety commissioner, because somehow this battle has become personal. Extraordinary story. Don't go anywhere. If you love a good documentary, then you'll love our special screenings. Uninterrupted Cinema features some of the latest or notable documentaries from the world's best filmmakers. You can check out TNT's website for more information. Weekends are better when you spend it with us on today's News Talk, TNT.
TNT's David Curtin.
Rishi Sunak is being threatening that he will do this and saying, oh, we'll do this, we'll come out of the ECHR, that is, not anything else. But he hasn't done so. And then he's saying, well, if we're elected in the general election this year, which is highly unlikely, then we may come out and we may give notice to come out if we're re-elected in 2024, 2025. By that time, another year or 2 years will have passed, and another 100,000 or so military-aged men will have crossed the channel in small boats with not a single flight taking off to take some bogus asylum seekers to Rwanda.
David Curtin on today's News Talk, TNT.
Turn on Alexa and ask her to play
TNT.
Turning on anything else usually requires dinner and conversation, dressing up and brushing your teeth, and I'm already tired.
This is today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour, Nathan Livingstone from Milk Bar TV. Now, before the break, I mentioned that Nathan caught the attention of the eSafety Commissioner. Now, who is the eSafety Commissioner? Well, she's an American woman, Julie Inman Grant. She looks like she could be on some sort of TV show, and she's making the most of her 15 minutes of fame, Nathan, because she's out there. She's ex-Twitter employee. She has been on the board of the World Economic Forum, and she caught the attention of the Albanese government, who has since quadrupled its funding of the eSafety Commissioner. The idea that we have to have electronic safety and a digital policeman or woman who's not Australian, not elected, and is going about the world telling us effectively that she is the chief censor. And she's made it personal in your case. Tell us what's going on here.
Yeah, so, I mean, effectively, the eSafety Commission is Australia's Ministry of Truth now, where they've decided what Australians can and can't see online. And that's, ranged from trans-related issues. So Jasmine Sussex was a prominent case last year where she spoke out and said that men can't breastfeed, something that I don't think, and I think most Australians would think, is a controversial statement. But that post was taken down and censored in Australia. And then recently, notably, Billboard Chris did a post where he called into question a man who identifies as a woman who has had a double mastectomy. And he's posted bestiality photos and promoted bondage and getting high during sex. And so Billboard Chris just asked, is this the kind of person that should be on a World Health Organization, WHO panel, advising on healthcare policy? The Safety Commission then made Twitter take down that post in Australia. I then interviewed him for my podcast where we discussed that. That did pretty well. A lot of people saw that. And then in the meantime, there's been these horrific attacks in Australia. There was the Bondi Junction mass murder. And then there was the stabbing of the bishop. And so we've seen then the eSafety Commission order footage from both of these incidents to be taken down online. So we've seen this office that was started to keep kids safe online slowly over time just increase its power more and more. And it was just recently, just last Friday, my wife came and showed me that someone from the eSafety Commission had searched her profile on LinkedIn. Now, it's important to point out that my wife doesn't share my last name on LinkedIn. She's very hard to find there. There's nothing in her past that would really suggest that the eSafety Commission would want to recruit her to work in their office. And she's a stay-at-home mum who hasn't actually been working for a while. She also isn't active on LinkedIn. So it was unusual because there was only one search. So only one profile had searched her profile, and that was the person who works at the eSafety Commission. So, I mean, the only reasonable explanation I can think of, and anyone's offered, was that they were searching her because of her connection to me and because of my activity criticizing and questioning the eSafety Commission. So I then launched a formal complaint, and so I emailed the eSafety Commission and ACMA, and I posted that online, and I've got a lot of support. And then that complaint was just me saying, asking the question of what's going on. I want transparency and I want accountability. If I'm being monitored, and even if people connected to me and my family are being monitored, I think I deserve to know. I've done nothing illegal. None of my posts have even been taken down by the eSafety Commission. The only thing I've done is criticize them and ask questions about them. So, if I'm being surveyed by them, I think I deserve answers, and I think Australians deserve answers.
You look at that behaviour, and eSafety Commissioner or eStalker Commission, the idea that we can subtly, stalk people online to gather information, if you will. There's absolutely no reason why they would stumble across a barely used social media profile of somebody who's got no interest in any of it, except for a connection that only someone who would have access to extra information would be able to make the connection with you, Nathan. If I can ask, I mean, how does your wife feel about this? Is this just something that you brush off in your daily exercise? Is it a little bit of perhaps notoriety, or is it more sinister? Does she even feel safe in her own home now?
No, she's a very private person. She's got an Instagram account, but, she doesn't post political content. She's not active like me. She's not involved in the day to day of the content with Milk Bar TV at all. It's just entirely me, so she finds it incredibly disturbing. And she, even kind of making it public, it's something that we've both agreed we should definitely do. It's important to do, and there's no doubt about that. But she still finds that very uncomfortable to have the spotlight on us. I make very viral videos, like millions of people watch them, and they cover a range of kind of issues to do with like the culture war and what's in the news. But it's very unusual for us to kind of have ourselves on the spotlight. So she's not comfortable about that. But it's not surprising. I don't think either of us are surprised that it's happening, but it's definitely concerning, it makes her very anxious and paranoid about what's going on. The LinkedIn is unique in that it keeps track of through searches for you, but it's this question of what else are they looking at? Are they looking at her Instagram? Are they looking at her, like Facebook? Are they looking at other members of my family? Are they looking at across the board, digging into me? But you go back and forth again where you kind of say it's just innocuous, it's just a search on LinkedIn, it's nothing big, and a few people have kind of downplayed it, but it's what you just mentioned, that there's no way that we can see that they can have that account information without having that extra information that comes with working at the eSafety Commission. So it's like they had to already have that to then be able to search it. And the only reason they have that is because they're searching into me and then into her by proximity.
This is the problem that many of us will have, and it's the idea that they can take criticism and then try and build it up to what they're going to call extremism to justify them taking action, which is only censorship. And what's worse is the way that these people behave is that they try and convince us that it's to protect democracy, when the opposite is that they're destroying the very fabric of what democracy is, the ability to criticize people holding positions in public office, whether they're appointed or whether they're elected. And so it is that they want to get this entire body of control. And would you believe it's only over what's seen on the internet? The idea that Bishop Emmanuel's video of this attempted stabbing or stabbing, you don't see a blade enter the body, you don't see any blood, you just see a mad teenager, raising his arm, moving fast at an obviously scared bishop, who retreats and the congregation gets up to assist. And at the same time, the Zapruder film, we see the president get his head blown off. That's okay. We can play videos of policemen and women attacking people during COVID. There's that infamous clip of one cop going up and picking up a man standing there in Melbourne and literally throwing him headfirst into the concrete floor. And we don't know if that man died or not, but he was severely injured in that particular attack. Why is it that it's so selective at this stage? How could it not be considered to be political at this stage to further an agenda, none of which serves the Australian people?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. The idea that this specific video is the catalyst for this sweeping overreach of censorship, when the video, like you said, features no blood, no gore, is non-lethal, the victim survived. The victim then went on to forgive the attacker. The victim themselves say they want the footage up online. The video you can search on YouTube and find on multiple news platforms, and was in fact broadcast on the news around the world. The idea that somehow this video is any kind of a threat and that then it should be the catalyst to enact, this over-the-top censorship is just absolutely preposterous. And it only invites questions into what's the larger motivation behind this. I've got my own theories about that. I personally think, because there was riots that followed that, that I think a lot of politicians were terrified that this would have a roll-on effect, and that this would then lead to more and more kind of, they continually refer to social cohesion. So I think they were worried that it would lead to more and more kind of chaos and some sort of a war between Islamists and Christians or something like this. But this didn't happen. This didn't happen. People didn't react that way. And, like I just said, the bishop himself forgave the victim. The only way I can see it is that they feel like they can't control social media, so they're trying to use this as an excuse to be able to regulate it, because they're afraid that people have too much power to be able to speak freely and see what they want to say. The government likes power and they want to control that.
Look, there's a number of different follow-ups here I want to talk to you about. And I guess the first one is, Nathan, well, look, there's probably 20 years age gap between us, but in your lifetime, did you ever think that we'd get into a situation that you would be not mature enough to handle your own affairs in society, that you needed the government to act on your behalf for your safety?
No, definitely not. And the idea that the government would take something like a terrorist incident and say that they don't believe that the Australian people have the right to view the incident for themselves, and that they need to protect Australians from being able to observe this incident. The idea that our politicians would believe that this would give us more faith and trust in them by them censoring these events is preposterous. It only invites more skepticism and questions about what they're hiding. People should absolutely have the power and the right to be able to watch these incidents and be able to ask questions and try and kind of understand and unpack what's happened. I think that's fundamental to a democracy, and to not have that, it only kind of leads us into this kind of Soviet totalitarian dystopian government nightmares.
And of course, we all know where that leads to. And this is the crazy thing, isn't it, that we live in this world that's upside down now, that people have been encouraged to become dependent on government. We saw it with the handouts during COVID, the $750 a week or whatever the money was that was just being thrown around. You didn't have to work, you know, only a couple of hours a week. You weren't working anymore. You got these massive handouts, which led to massive debt, huge rates, interest rate rises, big inflation. And of course, we certainly pay through the nose back for that little bit of short time. There. And of course, the government has only provided the disservice the whole way. The fact that they don't want to get to the bottom of who did this, they don't want to find blame on anyone, they'll sweep it under the carpet and move ahead. It feels like we're living in some sort of prison planet. I'm sure people go, of course we are, Jason, what are you saying? Well, it just seems so obvious now. But at the same time, the people causing the problems are the ones masquerading as the savior, and it's anything but. Again, I mean, this must help you in motivating you to make the videos that you do, Nathan, because it seems that there's no end of creativity or creative ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I never made kind of political videos or content before this. It's only kind of once that like fight ends up at your front door that you become activated and really start to kind of push back, and you kind of start to think like, oh well, it shouldn't have to kind of get to your front door. You know, you should be able to kind of see what's happening. But you know, with the pandemic, it happened overnight. At least it felt that way, and it doesn't feel like it's slowing down. It only feels like it's increasing. And you know, it's hard to really get the temperature of how the broader Australian public feel about this. I'd say it'll only be harder if they censor social media.
Because if you're only providing one side of the story, it just seems that society just gets its nose out of joint and responds in a different way. For example, this attacker of Bishop Emmanuel, 16-year-old boy, was reported yesterday in The Australian that his profile picture on one social media site was Osama bin Laden. On another social media site, it was people dressed up in black jihadi uniforms, costumes, whatever. It had previously been reported in The Guardian that he was known to police, that he was a troublemaker at school, and so the list goes on. And so when you put all that together, you would think that the average person in the street would be outraged. And of course, there may be, you know, people that would argue, well, he may have been influenced, or he was only a child, a 16-year-old, and provide a million different excuses. But none of this gets down to the facts. Now, another video that surfaced, and maybe it was an audio recording turned into a video, but there was another man of the same descent as of the attacker. And he was saying things like, I look up to this boy. He did something that was very courageous. It was something that he said, I woke up and I spat on myself for not being as courageous as this boy to do this. You never insult Muhammad type of conversation. This can't be real in today's society, that we have to pretend that that doesn't exist. That's the point. If you really want to talk about terrorism and extremism, it's staring us in the face, and all we're allowed to do is not talk about it. That can't be good for anyone, Nathan.
No, I mean, also it's not the role of the government to parent us. It's not the role of the government to decide what's too violent for us to see. I just don't believe that's the role of the government, and I don't believe that they should be regulating social media and telling them what they can and can't put on their sites. I firmly believe that, the fact that they haven't given one really good reason why this specific video needs to be taken down. They've given 20 terrible reasons, and most of them are pretty irrelevant. I even heard Anthony Albanese on Channel 9 arguing that it's bad business for Elon Musk to have this video on his platform. Why does Albanese care what's bad business for Elon Musk? Surely that's only a benefit for him if less people are using Twitter. But yet that, you know, he uses that as an argument. He uses, we got to keep kids safe. He uses that it was a terrorist video, yet, you know, Avi Yemeni said from Rebel News that the takedown order was for the bishop stabbing footage, but also for Bondi Junction, and both of the reasons where they were too violent. You know, so they're not being straight with us. They're not being honest and transparent. It just feels like they're trying to use any reason they can to add regulation. And, you know, it's up to all of us to really question their motivations behind that, which is what we're doing.
Well, I tell you, there's one thing for sure, Nathan, that Elon Musk will never be taking financial advice from Anthony Albanese, a self-confessed economic illiterate. I think it's hysterical, isn't it, that we're sitting here and Albanese can talk about anything to do with economics. He's got to be kidding himself. We're going to take another break. It's the last for my show for the day, and we're going to come back for the run home with Nathan Livingstone of Milk Bar TV. Don't go anywhere. You're watching and listening to Weekends here on TNT.
People might tell you that lime doesn't kill people, but we are losing people. People disappear from their lives.
One of the scariest things that I had to deal with was memory loss. Not just like I don't remember what I did last week, but like I forgot all the words to my own songs. I remember going to my primary care physician and he was like, "You are 100% healthy. There's nothing wrong with you." And my response was, "That's impossible. I'm dying."
I wasn't working. So I had all of these hospital bills. We had to move out of our home and move into my parents' basement.
I just wish I could have truly been present in those big moments, you know, when she took her first steps or, you know, her first day of preschool. Lyme is such a thief and it goes undetected because no one is looking for it.
For more information and prevention tips, go to projectlyme.org.
What do I love about riding? It's the thrill, the excitement. Riding gives me a sense of freedom. I feel so connected to the road. Riding is like therapy to me. It makes me feel alive. Love riding? Back off.
Weekends are better when you spend it with us. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
And welcome back to Weekends. This is the final segment for the weekend show, and coming up in the next segment, cinema. If you love a good doco, that's where you want to be. Now, my guest this hour, Nathan Livingstone of Milk Bar TV. Nathan, you have covered in some detail the story of Andrew Tate, and I was hoping that you could just sort of take me back. When did this story catch your attention in terms of him being charged, not charged, human trafficking? He's an MMA fighter and a huge profile on social media. It seems that every time he does something, it trends on X, but now he's in a lot of hot water. Tell us how you got to focus on this story.
I was aware of Andrew Tate for a little while, but he wasn't someone that I really looked into. And he wasn't someone that I necessarily felt one way or the other about. I understood that he kind of came to prominence as somewhat of a reaction to the Me Too movement and somewhat of a kind of a correction to that, turning into this kind of mob ruling where it started to kind of attack men and masculinity. So I think that's why he kind of gained prominence, because he was speaking up for men. And I think a lot of people supported that. But he was kind of on my radar once he started doing interviews with Piers Morgan and some bigger profile people. I was aware that he was arrested in Romania. But again, I wasn't really sure what the criminal case was about. But it was by the time that he did an interview with Tucker Carlson in July last year that I took notice, because that was very big on Twitter, on X, which is kind of where I spent a lot of time on. And I realized during that interview that he had straight up lied about what he was charged with. I thought that was interesting because it's not unusual for people to maybe question or to put their side of what's going on with a criminal case when it's to do with them. But I think it's very unusual for you to lie about what you've been charged with. That's a black and white thing. So he lied and said that he wasn't charged with rape, and there was a couple of other things. So that's when I kind of really looked into him, and I realized that he had lied about a whole lot of things, and that he was actually quite a despicable character. And he was a straight up online pimp who had a webcam service where he groomed women into sex workers. And he even taught courses about how to groom women into sex work. And the more and more I discovered and uncovered about him, the more and more I found it was really disturbing. And that he tried to kind of reform his image as this kind of truth teller with COVID. So he took a stand against COVID vaccines. So a lot of people that were kind of in my circle had embraced him because they saw him as an ally fighting the same kind of enemies when it came to like globalist threat. But I kind of realized that he was actually a con man who had taken on this persona to try and kind of launder his criminal background and his kind of smutty background. So I made this video, and I made it just like any other video. And for some reason, this one just hit at the right time. And it's maybe my most viral video, and it was shared by like Ben Shapiro and Jordan Peterson and a whole bunch of people covered on their podcast. And so that got nearly like 12 million views. Very, very viral. And then since then, I've continued to kind of look into the case, and I've continued to work with a group of anonymous accounts called Team Matrix. And they're people who've really exposed and done hard work to actually really uncover what's going on with his criminal case and to battle the propaganda that he pushes, especially around his criminal case, and to actually inform people about what's really going on there.
So incredible work that you've done there, and working together with others trying to get to the truth. Now, that's the point of this whole work that we do, is becoming the new media, whichever way that forms, whether it's traditional forms, online, new ways of telling stories, etc., which is part of your specialty, your expertise, this talent that you have in spades. How do you expose a con man, if you will, such as someone that you're claiming here as Andrew Tate, which is fairly clear when you see the way he's behaved? Why do you think he got onto the COVID narrative the way that he did? Was it, are you looking at it from a perspective to curry favor with a certain group, to maybe insulate, to maybe just cling on, or perhaps even to white ant the truth movement, to infiltrate it in many ways, to discredit it and divide it even further? How do you perceive it all?
He's someone who he has kind of shape-shifted throughout his life. So like you said, he used to be a kickboxer, and then he wanted to be a reality TV star. He was on Big Brother. He had his own kind of reality show called Tate Confidential. And then throughout as well, he was a digital pimp. But he was also a kind of a guru where he kind of taught courses on how to kind of pick up women. Then with the pandemic, with the COVID vaccines, he then kind of moved into this truth-telling digital new media space where he then started doing podcasts and live streams. But I think what he did was he was quite smart, because he realized that the kind of people who see globalism as a threat are exactly the kind of people that you're then able to manipulate, and you're then able to hide your crimes and what you've done, because then all you need to do is reframe everything as an attack by them or by what he calls the Matrix. So then what he does is when he's arrested and charged with these very real crimes, he then just says he's being attacked by the government, by the globalist threat, because of him telling the truth. And then he tries to kind of put himself in the same space as a Julian Assange or a Edward Snowden, which is just blatantly just ridiculous when you actually listen to what he has to say. This isn't someone who's exposed government collusion or corruption, or has kind of, you know, documents and receipts proving that the government's killed people and done kind of war crimes, or is proving that our intel agencies are spying on us. This is a pimp who sex trafficked women, who has pretty much said anything that probably you've said or that I've said, in that COVID vaccines are harmful and that there's a globalist threat. So it's very preposterous, this kind of idea that somehow he's being targeted because he's telling the truth. But he's found that there's a large group of people that will buy into that, but that will also grift on that same space, and they will kind of use his very large following to prop up, you know, what they're doing.
There's so much to unpack, isn't there, in how this is playing out? Because there's a theme going around in the truth movement, if we give it that name, that wants to pick out people and label them controlled opposition as ways that that they seem to be perhaps roadblocking this pathway to a great awakening, if you will. A perfect case in point was that this week, Clive Palmer, who is the United Australia Party Australian billionaire miner, was quite successful after the political campaign of 2022 last year, when he brought out Peter McCullough, the cardiologist, on a speaking tour and sold out tickets all around the place. And I remember saying to Senator Ralph Babette at the time that maybe this is what Clive's thing is, that he becomes a promoter and brings out people that otherwise you wouldn't have access to. Well, this week we saw that he announced that he's bringing Tucker Carlson to Australia. Now, tickets aren't cheap, somewhere between $200 and $300 each at the Sydney venue where I checked for pricing. So you certainly have to consider whether you want to go along. But at one point, if you're thinking Tucker Carlson would have to be the world's most recognised alternate, well, let's say anti-establishment newscaster at the moment. So to be able to see him or hear him in person direct a message to the Australian people has got to have value. Now, interestingly, on social media yesterday, when people started to talk about it, immediately I saw some decent influencers, you know, small 5, 10, 15,000 followers putting things out there. And you get the usual suspects, I call them. Oh, that's controlled opposition. That's controlled opposition. Oh, yeah, that's the same again. Oh, this is no good. That's no good. And I thought, hang on a second. If Tucker Carlson can get 100 million people watching his Trump interview, if Tucker Carlson can get 10 to 20 to 30 million people watching his content, then surely there's got to be something that's a little bit bigger than just saying he's controlled opposition because you don't like Clive Palmer because once he wore red shoes and he might not have paid wages to his staff, which he actually did. I mean, how confused can we be, and why do we make preconceived judgments on certain things without looking at the big picture? Surely to goodness, we can simplify this and go, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and we are fighting an information war technically between globalism and those who are nationalists, if you will, that don't want to be part of a one world government. Why do we complicate everything so much in this process, do you think?
So no, I mean, I have the same frustration. It's a similar thing where, you know, everything is a psyop to these same people. In my mind, I think that it's become a religion, the same thing like woke. It's just kind of in this space where it's very comforting to group people into one thing. I think it's the same. I think there's the same danger when you think that the WEF, the Klaus Schwab, is somehow controlling everything, or the UN is controlling everything. I'm not sure. You start to kind of connect these dots, and your critical thinking goes outside the window. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm proud that I've never got a community note on Twitter, which is like a fact check, you know. And the community notes are broken. There's flaws with them, but I think they're still effective. I think it's important to still hold on to the truth and to not kind of fall into agendas and to fall into being biased in one way or another, and to fall into these echo chambers. It's very easy, and you know that is one of the flaws with social media. You can kind of fall into these traps, and you can only kind of look for things that support a conclusion that you've already made. And I think that's incredibly, incredibly dangerous. And I think that's why, you know, when I made the videos against Andrew Tate, there was a lot of people that just didn't want to accept it because, you know, it was that thing of, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my kind of ally type thing. And so they just didn't want to, they don't have that ability to be able to say, okay, well, yeah, he's saying these bad things about this guy, but you know, he's also a bad guy, so I'm not going to support him. You know, for a lot of people, they're just like, well, that's the biggest threat that we have. So anyone that's imposing that, well, then they're on my side. I'm going to disregard everything else. And I think that's incredibly dangerous, and we shouldn't be moving in that direction.
It's interesting, isn't it, that when we go back to Andrew Tate for a moment, and if these charges are proven, then we're dealing with a nasty individual, and of course with his brother there. But at the same time, the same people who are having a go at you about Tate, a knot in terms of Harvey Weinstein, who we learnt just this week had his original conviction overturned and a new trial set. He won't get out of jail because of the other conviction in California where he got 16 years. But what's the difference, therefore, between Weinstein's behaviour and Tate's behaviour?
It's the same thing with Epstein as well. You know, people aren't going to be supporting Epstein. People see Epstein as someone who's incredibly, you know, a despicable character, and they see him as someone who is a tool for forces that we haven't quite been able to name. You know, he was a sex trafficker who preyed on underage girls, so is Andrew Tate. It's important I continually ask these people who defend Andrew Tate, I ask what evidence would require for you to be able to acknowledge that he's guilty, because there is a mountain of evidence. Now, I think, of course, he deserves a fair trial, and he should get one, and everything up to this point has proved that he will. There's been no corruption or anything at this point, and a trial is going ahead. That's just been announced. They haven't announced yet what the date is, but there's a mountain of evidence. I mean, this guy literally taught a course online about how to use the same grooming techniques that he used, the same grooming techniques called the Loverboy method that he's been charged with. I've never seen another case in my lifetime of someone self-snitching and leaving more and more evidence of themselves confessing online than Andrew Tate. Yet people can watch him admit with his own words on video and still deny it. It's, you know, it's quite incredible to see.
Well, this is not isolated to people on this side of the fence, because if we're really serious about it, what Prince Andrew said in that train wreck interview when they were asking him about Epstein and his relationship, and his response was, oh, I wasn't friends with Jeffrey. I was friends with his girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell. Well, Ghislaine Maxwell turns out that she's equally, if not worse, than Epstein. But people don't seem to get that upset with Prince Andrew. And if we extend that a little bit further, it was Jimmy Savile who was best friends with now King Charles. You can't get a worse possible scenario than having Jimmy Savile as your best friend. And people will say to me, oh, look, he might not have known. And I say, look, with all due respect, it was his own mother's, Her Majesty's Secret Service. It's impossible that they didn't know. And therefore, what are we dealing with him? So we just have apologists on both sides living in denial, heads in the sand. It's a shocking situation. How do you put that together?
Yeah, look, it's the same thing with Andrew Tate. He's got powerful connections. You know, he hung out with powerful people in the UK and in America on the right. You know, it's tribalism for me. It's the same thing with the MAGA movement and all sorts of things. It's, you know, there's just not a lot of critical thinking. People are very tribal and they're very biased. And I think it's important to always look at flaws and the best arguments against what you're arguing for.
Absolutely. Now, we are getting close to the end of the hour. For people who would like to check out your work, where's the best place to find you, Nathan?
Twitter is where I'm most active, on X. So you can find me there at The Milk Bar TV. And I've got pinned, my pinned tweet, so the first thing you'll see is the open letter formal complaint against the eSafety Commissioner. So if you're on Twitter, share that. If not, you can just read through that. I want people to kind of be aware of that, because I think it's alarming to me and to every other Australian if this Ministry of Truth, eSafety Commission, is monitoring Australian citizens.
No, absolutely. Now, you haven't received a response yet back from that office?
Not yet, no. But I tell you what, I've got some notable politicians, senators and ministers that have got my full support, and they're also going to look into the matter.
Oh, fantastic. Well, more power to you, Nathan. It's been a delight to be able to speak to you today on the show and to continue to look at the great work that you're doing. Who knew that that COVID would deliver you into the profession that you were born for? It's a remarkable thing, and I'm delighted that we've been able to connect and continue to watch the work that you're doing. That's it for me for today. We're going to take a break, and coming up after the break, it's documentary time. Cinema is up next. Thanks for watching. I'll see you all next week. This is Jason Olborn signing off today for TNT.